Sorry, I've just got a bang on the door. I don't know who this is. Are you still recording? I'm annoyed now.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast for another week. As you can probably hear from the intro, joined this week by Vic Metro's Darren Best. Welcome, Bestie.
Good to be here. Hopefully everybody outside this room is quiet.
It was a bit of an interesting week last week. Jenna O'Hay from the Vic Metro Women, welcome back as well.
Thank you.
Once again, a reminder for everyone, you can follow along on X and Instagram using the @TalkingSplit handle. Apologies, we actually forgot to film the draw on Saturday that we were talking about on last week's podcast. We will film it this Saturday and post it on the socials for those that wanted it. That's an error on my end. Apologies there. Fantastic to have you both in. We do have a quick coach shout-out before we get into the actual topic of the podcast. So the coach shout-out is for Brett Harvey, who's the Director of Coaching at Northeast Bushrangers and the FTP Head Coach in the Northeast. An exceptional mentor to the young coaches in the region, has worked to build an athlete-first club focused on the continual growth and development of the Northeast athletes. Brings a passion to his coaching that inspires his peers to bring the same, and the Northeast region is fortunate to have Brett active in the coaching world, providing opportunities for athletes to pursue BV pathways. Coaches across the area can also appreciate his commitment to developing more and more coaches. Has been a great mentor for many and provides people with a great platform to grow. So fantastic acknowledgement for coaches in the pathway. I know Brett also delivers coaching courses for me, which I also appreciate because it saves me driving up into the northeast of Victoria. So fantastic on that end as well. If you do have any coach shout-outs, by all means, just send them through. It doesn't matter if it's your domestic coach, if it's a rep coach, or if it's your SDP coach, whatever the case may be, parents, players, whoever it might be, just a little bit of acknowledgement for the coaches I think goes a really long way. It's amazing how many times everyone says, oh yeah, I'll send you one of those, and then we never get them. It's like the whole dog ate my homework stuff. Like, it comes eventually, but not all the time. So if there are people out there that do have coach shout-outs, please do send those through as we get into it. Podcast topic today, opinions you're prepared to die on the hill over. So this is just a little bit different more than anything else. We obviously throw out opinions like they're false currency around here that we can get into as we go through it. We'll bounce around. There is always the caveat of we can change our mind, which Jenna will get into in a second because she's going to go first on this one. But it is just some things that we might believe in the basketball landscape, I think, more than anything else. And Jenna, your first one is my opinion will always change.
Yeah, always. And I think that's the beauty of sport and basketball and life in general, that we're able to have our opinions be changed. And I'm constantly trying to learn. I was like that as a player, and I'm like that as a coach as well. And things are always going to be evolving and changing, and I hope that throughout my entire life I continue to, be adaptable and be changeable. And, I'm very happy for my opinion to change on things.
What's the last thing you changed on, just out of curiosity?
That's a good question. Off the top of my head, I don't have anything straight away, but I'm trying to be as fluid as I can in terms of listening to different things and taking it on board. And I'm always trying to be a sponge with knowledge and really take that on board.
Yeah, and it happens continually. Like, we might have an opinion on a player or an opinion on a coach, or hey, I don't like this type of action. Then all of a sudden we see it work and it's like, actually, it's not that bad. Like, it's, I like where they've gone with it. There are so many things around it, I think, that we can sort of talk about. But the biggest thing is you have to be open to it. Like, it's that growth mindset mentality we talk about with our players a lot, that, you know, we want you to trial and error things. We want you to have different takes on different things. We as coaches have to be the same way. Basketball's not played the same way now as it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, not 10 weeks ago. It feels like it changed depending on what you were doing. But it is one of those areas that if we always go in with the same opinion, we're always going to get the same result. And we may not be evolving as coaches, as players, as a game to the level we should. I think that's a difficult part to get right.
Yeah, and I think with each team that you coach, you're never going to have the same 12 players back-to-back seasons. So what works for one group isn't necessarily going to work for the next group. So you need to be able to change, and you need to be able to best suit what suits your team at the time.
What's the last thing you changed on, Bestie?
Probably the biggest one was D-Trans philosophy. I love tagging up, but it's more just the time spent that we don't necessarily have in our environments here. Like, you need it, you need to practice it daily because it is so different, and you need a designated coach to do it, and you also probably need to recruit the right type of players to do it, you know. So if I was maybe at a college or something like that, I'd potentially look at doing it because I like the disruption advantages that it has. But it's just the time that you have, how are you budgeting it? So now I've gone back to a more traditional point guard to the nail, wings back, you know, five can rebound if your man rebounds, that type of thing. So,
yep.
And it's been better because it doesn't require as much coaching.
Yeah, and it's, I suppose it's that whole cost-benefit analysis to right. like how much you're prepared to put into it. Is that going to outweigh what you get out of it? Those type of things. I've always been the same with run and jump.
Yeah, right.
Like in the full court, like I love it to death. Does it pay off for the amount of time I have to spend for it? Do I have the personnel for it? Those types of things. Not always. I think for tournaments, it probably does because I think it can win you the right quarter at the right time to maybe shift the needle over a season. I'd probably just prefer better skilled players. But so it's that kind of thing. Like I'm kind of in that sort of world as well. And it actually ties into one of the ones that I wasn't going to jump on, but I will now because it just leans in nicely. But probably ego will cost more coaches than ability over the court. Like that's something I genuinely believe. The refusal to budge on something because, no, this is how we do it. We do it this way and we only do it this way. And this is the hill I will die on type stuff. That will cost you more games than your actual coaching ability. Coaching ability is a little bit of a fraught with danger term that everyone, they're a great coach. Why are they a great coach? Like what makes them a great coach? Do they read the game well? Are they a great developer of skill sets? Are they a great developer of athletes? Those types of things. It's not always a fleshed out package. Like some will have other areas that are great at others. Same as their players. Some will be great shooters but poor defenders. You know, it's the same with coaches. Some are great developers but not great game coaches. They don't see the game well or their understanding of things may not be at the same level of others. But it's that shelving of the ego, I think, is an important part of it. It's like, well, like it's not about me. Like it's about my team. What do I have to do here? Do I have to deviate from something I've been doing the whole time to get a better outcome? Potentially. So that's one of the things I am big on.
We had a real live example of that in our youth league game on Saturday. So we knew the
coach
team
of the month last month. Incidentally,
stop.
Hey, the best.
We knew the team that we played against ran a lot of Spain ball screen, and we practiced defending it a certain way on Thursday, and we were comfortable with it. Got to the game, and the group wasn't comfortable with it. So during one of the timeouts, we addressed it in the first quarter, and then they just started three-way switching it, right? And we had a good mobile group. We went into the locker room at halftime, and I said, "We're not getting it done the first way. You guys obviously feel more comfortable doing it this way." They said yes, and I said, "Okay then, but Biggs, if you get burnt, you're coming out." And they're like, "Yep, okay." So that's an example of, you know, the group felt more comfortable doing it. But it was still me saying, well, if you're going to do this and the big's going to end up on the guard, you better be able to stay in front of him. And they did. So,
yep. It's a great example of it, yeah. In all honesty. A younger Rob would have certainly stuck with no bad luck. This is how we've taught it. This is what we're doing. This is how we're going to do it. You've got to adjust. Whereas I'd like to think a more mature one would maybe go with what you've gone with there and the players have figured it out. So, well, that's what we lean into. The only reason I bring up the coach of the month thing is Andy Lim is a little bit salty that it wasn't him. They got the gig.
He actually mentioned that to me on Saturday.
He did.
Did he say that to you as well?
He did. Yeah. So we'll continue to remind him that he's missed out on that award.
Too bad, Andy.
Yeah, exactly how it works. Bestie, we're on to you for the next one, though. Shell drill at every single practice.
Every practice. Got to do it. I just think defending the ball is important, obviously. Defending actions, too. Like, I don't often do just, you know, whip the ball around the perimeter. We might do that to start with some closeout rehearsal and stunting, but then it needs to be some sort of action into an action. Maybe it's a passing card or away screen or even a ball screen. But I think it just the defensive fundamental and foundation of, you know, defending needs to be something that's practiced. We start a lot of our sessions with it, whether it's 4-on-4 or 5-on-5, straight away into it. Jenna and I had a conversation about it. She did it once and then one of her players got injured straight away. Yep. We're at the point now where our players, like I've told him, if you stuff around during your warm-up, you are going to get hurt because we start and we're competing straight away. It works well with the boys. You know, there's no like gradual build-up. It's like practices on, we're competing straight away. It seems to work well for the boys. But yeah, I just think you can't get upset, you know, if you're not defending, if you don't prioritize it. Like we've all heard the saying, you will be good at what you prioritize. So every practice, I like it at the start of practice, sometimes even twice in practice. You know, most of the session plans that I have always start with Shell.
Yep.
And it's like individually you can practice your ball skills, you can do your shooting. It's really hard to practice defense on your own. So it needs to be a focus and a priority at training.
Yeah, without a doubt. Like it's, you know, yes, we all want to do a shooting session and those types of things, but you can kind of do that in your own time. But can you help when you need to help based on what the structure looks like in front of you, what the offense is doing, those types of things? You can't. Like it's a great point. It's one of those things where I think people have gone away from shell drill because they've all, oh, it's not gamey enough. And it's like, well, no, it is the ultimate game. Like it's, then you get the usual question I get in every coaching course I take. Yeah, but where does the fifth player go when you're doing like 4-on-4 shell? It's like, no, there is a fifth player. Like they can still be on split. It's okay. Like throw a post in or we'll throw another player on 5 out. But even the positioning, like we have so many coaches now that talk about, oh, I can't get my players to deny. It's like, well, put them in shell. Like start them in the denial stance. Get them beat a couple of times. Get the next layer of help to go and help on those types of things. That builds what your team should really look like in that world.
I think a lot of us, like, we just use the word shell.
Yeah.
But it's really not. Like, it's the way I do it. It's more just man-to-man defense, I guess. You're just starting that. Because you could still do it with your 5 out. You can do it with, a dunker post. You can do it anything. And like I said, they're just moving the ball around and going, you know, from ball to help or split, blow, whatever you want to call it. You don't really do that. Like, we do it to a point where it's defend this action or defend this drive and, you know, but we just call it shell, I guess.
Well, yeah. It's mentally switching you on as well.
Yeah.
Like that's the big thing I find.
And it's something that on the girls' side is a bit of an issue, but communication, they don't talk. If you're starting in shell and you have to communicate in shell if you're defending different actions. So it's a great way to start.
I actually think that just mundane, just going from like ball, gap, split, gap, ball, like that's why the players switch off.
Yep.
You can do it for 1 or 2 reps each and then it's like right now it's this action defending this.
Yep. So what are the actions you use most out of shell to try and defend? Like what are you sort of focusing on at the moment?
Well, obviously depends age group specific. So with FDP, we're still doing defending pass and cut.
Yep.
And the biggest one is defending the second cut. So, you know, let's say it's a seam to wing pass and cut. It's the cutter filling where the ball originated from. So defending that cut as well. Defending down screens. So we're working on that. But when we get, you know, older into whether it's state teams or even with my youth league team, it's always the action into a ball screen is what most of it is, whether it's a like pin down into a ball screen, zipper or whatever into a ball screen.
Yep, so, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm completely with you on that one. That is a must at everyone. Even if you only have 6 kids to practice, you can still get some shell stuff in there.
Definitely.
It doesn't have to be 4-on-4. And that, I think that's one of the rubs on it is everyone thinks it has to be 4-on-4 shell. It can be 3-on-3. It can be 2-on-2. If you want. Like there are ways that you can manipulate this where you potentially need to. So absolutely agree with that. Jenna, we're on to you next on this one. Good people over good players.
Yeah, I'm so strong on this. Probably with a lot of teams that I've been on, if there is, I'll call it a cancer in that group, it really flows through quickly. So if I have someone who generally when you're picking a team, I just prioritize good people all the time because if you know they're good people, they're going to buy in, they're going to work hard. Think if it's two similar style players, then absolutely, there's a good teammate who gets around each other, who is really supportive, who is looking you in the eyes, who is respectful. I think that goes a long way for me when picking teams. Of course, you always need talent in a basketball team. I'm not saying that you don't, but I definitely just culturally, you need good people to make a team work.
Yeah, and it tends to be the end of the bench in those types of positions where you might all have the same 8 or 9 people picked, but then you look at the potential role that they're going to have to play and it's like, well, how would this person deal with not getting many minutes or not getting many shots or having to play, you know, a secondary defender type role? How would they deal with that? And if they're not the person, well, that it doesn't mean they're a bad person, but it just means they're not the fit for what that looks like. And I don't know, it's a big part of picking teams is that who wants the headaches? So it becomes a massive part of selections in general where, yeah, okay. Are you always going to take more talent? If you can, sure. But it also goes into what we deal with as coaches is that how do we make people better people? And basketball is really the vehicle for that, I would hope, to make people better people. And, you know, the whole resilience side of things, the character building, the setbacks, the adulation, those types of things, all build into a massive part of it. We don't always have that choice, though. Sometimes in the junior teams, it's like, well, they're your 10 kids, away you go. How would you go about maybe shifting someone that maybe isn't necessarily a bad person, but maybe doesn't quite have the same viewpoint as everyone else to be a good fit for a team? Like, is there anything you would do in that world?
I think you have to have some frank conversations. You have to make them accountable. And as a coach, you need to be accountable for making sure that that team functions correctly. And if there's someone who is stepping out, then yeah, it's going to be a frank conversation with that person. They're either buying in or they're not.
Yep. And I think with the younger kids too, it's a good time to get the parent involved. And that's a, hey, we're going to have a chat. Bring mum and dad in. Have a listen to this. Okay, here's what I'm seeing. Here's what you can help me with. Here's where the adjustments need to be on your end. Because we don't want the first time they ever get held accountable to be when they're like 32. Like, it's too late by that stage. Like, you want it when they're, you know, 12, 13, 14, so you can actually make some inroads to people. Like, that's so hard to do, but it's such a big part of it. Like, I know you're in that team selection world a lot, Bestie. Like, how much does character play a big part of that?
A lot. You know, it's, we've had, I've got to be careful what I say here. I've had people throughout this season, after a game, from the opposition team say to me, keep a spot for me next year, man.
Yep.
Right, like as we're shaking hands.
Wow.
And I'm just, and you're just like, you don't know what to say to him. What you really want to say to him is, come to trial, but you're probably going to get cut.
Yeah.
You know, like.
It's valid.
Yeah. It's, and it's been multiples. It's not just one. You know, so clearly they're salty with their current situation and they've checked out already, you know. We still have like 9 games to go in our season, you know, so that's alarming when people say that to you. We also, you know, throughout the years have had people quit, you know, and I've had to say to them, what are you going to say to, you know, your next coach when they ask you why? You know, you need to be aware of this. Like, are you prepared to say the reasons why? Because good coaches will also probably call me to find out what happened, you know? So some of those things are the lessons, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, into mine next. No bounce passes in transition. It's just a pet peeve. Like, I've just seen it. Like, if you were to survey all my players that I've ever had in my life, and it's like, what's the one message that Rob left with you? It is, don't throw bounce passes in transition.
You would have hated coaching me.
Really?
I used to love a full court bounce pass.
A full court bounce
pass? Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. Right.
Interesting. Okay, well, you know, I'd like to think that you may know more than me in that sort of space. You know, you have a reasonable career, but it is one of those
opinions that you can change.
This is how it works, Bestie. You don't have to die on every hill. Maybe you can just be wounded on this hill. Like, it is.
Now, coaches probably hated me, but I used to love threading the needle and bouncing it through on a full court bounce pass.
But it's kind of one of those things too, where you know, I'll take good shots. Someone throws out some rubbish and it goes in. It's like, ah, that's okay. Like, it's one of those things. Yeah, if it comes off, everyone's pretty happy with it. But so many times, and my issue actually comes with the skill of throwing a bounce pass, in that so many times people just throw it and it hits the floor hoping that it will get there rather than throwing it into the floor to get there. That's kind of my real issue with it. Like, I saw the kid's name, Queensland North kid, Tamari Wignes, like throw literally a full court bounce pass and he hit the floor and kicked up straight to the running player in a layup. It's like, and two of my players sort of turned at me and was like, what would you think about that? I'm like, we're good. Like, that one's fine. If you throw them like that, we are fine. Like, you can throw them into your heart's content. I just find it tends to be, ball obviously slows down by the time it hits the floor. It tends to usually be behind them.
Yeah.
That's kind of my killer. And there's an element too of, I want my players catching it at sort of chest, head height and having a quick finish rather than having to look, take their eyes off the rim, look down to find the basketball, then go score it. So I'm wounded on the hill. I'm probably not dying on the hill. I'm wounded on the hill. I would prefer you not throw bounce passes in transition, but I understand there is a time and a place for it. Like, it's, you know, I can't fix that one all the time, unfortunately, but that's just kind of my read on it. So that's how it works. Bestie, you're on to the next one, though. D-trans in every team training session.
Yeah, I think there's a difference. You know, we've got to identify what we're working on here, whether it's team practice or skill sessions or whatever. But, yeah, we know, what is it now? It's probably north of 60% of scores are happening in transition. So if you want to have a chance, you got to work on some full court D. I think it's that simple. So you've got to have it every practice,
yep.
Whether it's, you know, through drills or through Just that's the emphasis with your coaching group, but it's got to be addressed every practice, I think. Yeah, just the sheer number of scores that are happening in broken play or transition logically says you need to spend time defending it.
Yep. Yeah. I'd be really interested as well in coaches. It's a worthwhile exercise. I was talking to a coach just last night about coaching philosophy, and we sort of deviated onto a couple of different topics. And the coach said, look, I thought I knew what my philosophy was, but then I asked my players and they gave me something completely different coming back the other way. How interesting. Yeah, and she said the same thing. She's like, I had no idea. Like, this is what they thought. She's like, I always thought I was a defensive coach. And they're like, nope, you're not. You're an offensive coach. And I'd just be really curious to know how many of your players know what your defensive transition rules actually are. And it kind of aligns with the same thing. You know your rules, obviously, as the coach, but do your players? And can they really verbalise them? And because if they can't verbalise them, they probably can't hold teammates accountable either. Like, it comes in from a number of different sort of areas. It's like, so you're talking about, you've gone back to the more traditional defensive transition side of things. Was that like a really, because you obviously had some carryover from last year's group where I'm assuming you tagged up last
year? No, didn't. No, we'd already made that change.
You've already made the shift. Okay.
Yeah.
Which is fine too. Like, it's, but it is something that I think everyone walks in and does the same thing. This is our offense. This is what we're running. This will be our zone change up. But D-Trans kind of comes last out of all that. And it probably should be a little bit further up the pecking order, because we should really start with, here's our offense and here are our D-Trans spots out of our offense. It's almost the continuity of what comes next, I suppose. But, you know, I get it. Not everyone gets a full court too. So you've got to be careful as to how you would teach it.
It's something that we added into our FDP sessions, that after a score, teams taking it out and you're in your defensive trans spots, just to get it in their heads of where they need to be. So even if it is in just in a half court, you can still get into your defensive transition rules and principles to sort of back to the half court again.
Yep.
So you can always add it in.
Yeah, for sure. And when you really look at how the game is played, you're either in offense or defense, or offensive transition or defensive transition. You're probably going to be in the transition phases more often than you are solely offense or defense. It just tends to happen that way. Turnovers happen, errors happen, terrible shots happen, like bad defender happen, whatever the case may be. You're going to be in transition more than probably anything else. And as you say, Bestie, like over 60% of the points will come from transition baskets. Watching the Country and Metro women play on Sunday, all of it would have been transition. There wasn't a lot in the half court that it's like, that's well executed and that's a score. It was all transition stuff. And look, to be fair, it was pretty well defended by the same token, but it's kind of that backbreaker layup that you don't want to give up in the third or fourth quarter where it game's tied. Someone forgets, runs the wrong way, and all of a sudden leak out layup and game's done. It has to be a flick of the switch moment, I think, for mine. So it's I like it. The D-Trans stuff is just underspoken about. I think that's kind of my thing. Everyone gets really caught up on what our offense looks like, but you know, if you get your D-Trans right, you get to play more offense more often. So it'll work out.
Yeah, and I don't know any teams that are terrible in D-Trans that are winners.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, you think back to the Phoenix Suns, 7 seconds or less era. Not a great defensive transition team. Like, they put up a lot of numbers, but they gave up a lot of numbers at the same time. It doesn't tend to be what holds you over.
Yeah, it's we had this issue last year with our youth league team. We were, you know, probably the best offense in the league. We averaged the most points per game, but our D wasn't great. So we identified that coming into this whole preseason. It was all about that. And we just said, look, when you're dealing with young kids, it's probably a little bit different than if you're dealing with pros. And like the NBA, for example, with that Phoenix Suns team, like, I know they didn't win a title, but they were perennial playoff teams. And over the course of 82 games, their shooting averages are going to be their averages and all that type of stuff. But when you're dealing with younger kids, like, if you're solely reliant on the O, they're going to have patches where they don't score, you know, because they're just not that accomplished. So it's the D. Like, I've also had these conversations around, would you rather start, you know, your best offensive group or your best defensive group? And, you know, most teams try and find a blend of that. But if I had to choose one or the other, it would be the D, because naturally kids and players are a little bit anxious at the start of the game, and you don't want to get punched in the face with a team going like 10-0 or something because some shots haven't fallen, but they're also not great defensively. Whereas at least you can just dig in and, you know, it might be 4-0 after 5 minutes. You know, yeah, we've all been in those games. Like, all right, well, we're okay now. Like, those nerves are sort of, you know, just the tension from the start of the game has worn off.
Yeah, we've all been in those games. My team's usually the zero, not the 10, as it turns out. But when you talk about the Phoenix Suns era, the team they ran into all the time, the Spurs, who religiously shell drill, first drill of every training session. So you've emphasised your own point there, Bessie. I don't know if you meant to or not, but we'll
I didn't, credit but...
Yeah, we'll let you do it. Absolutely, no problem with that. Jenna, we're on to you next. Relationship building being an absolute key part of coaching now.
Yeah, I just think life in general, I think it's all about relationships with the people around you. And I think in coaching, it's just so important. The relationships that you build with your players, it goes into that trust that you have with them and them back to you, which I think is so important in the game of basketball and in life as well. I think it just carries a lot of weight within a team if you are able to build relationships.
Yeah, and the honesty and the humility side of things too. Like, I think from a coach, I always found I got more respect from my players when I'd put my hand up and say, yeah, I screwed that one up. Like, that one's on me. That's not on you. Scout was wrong. I didn't teach it correctly. I made the wrong call on the sub or the timeout or whatever the case may be. That will build a better relationship. Like, that little bit of humility, I think, from the coaching end too.
And I'm really glad you highlighted that, because I don't mean be best friends with your players yeah, off the court and going around to that. I don't mean all of that. I mean that stuff. It's so important. And yeah, they're just going to look to you so much more if you can build that trust and relationship with them.
How early do you start that? Is that literally from session one of the season?
For me, it is.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's constantly evolving as well. Yep. You're not going to learn it all in that one session. And I think the more you get to know your players, you will know what makes them tick. There are some players that you can put a rocket under them and it will absolutely lift them. Some other players, it'll make them cry and you'll lose them completely. So being able to understand what your players need and when comes with that relationship building. So it is so important.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a player I was working with years ago now that had just come back from college. And I said, well, look, you know, she came in halfway through a season. So we kind of had our group structured already. Everyone was kind of what they were. And adding an extra piece can always be a little bit of a shift with the dynamic in the team. I remember talking to him. I was like, well, you know, what do you need? Do you need to be, like, motivated? Do you need a little bit of, like, care? Like, what motivates you? She's like, oh, well, no one's ever really asked me this before. She's like, but I've just come back from college where I got yelled at for 4 years. So probably that one. Like, that one makes the most sense to me. And it's like, okay, well, that's if that's what you want, like, I am your guy. Like, I can do that.
That that's I can do. Yeah.
That's my wheelhouse. So it was one of those things where it's like, well, no one's ever actually asked me what I want in that sort of space. And, yeah, all those sorts of things like preseason surveys, like the team building exercise, those types of things will really give you a bit of insight as to what they are. I know Jenny used to talk about it a lot, but getting them to do something that wasn't basketball as a bit of a team building exercise, because you get to find out, like, your players are your players when they're there and they're all good at basketball, so they all have their sort of, not a pecking order as such, but they know where they sort of sit. But her thing was, we'll get them to do something they're all bad at, and then you'll actually find out about what makes them tick, what doesn't make them, like, which one just, like, throw the toys out of the cot when it doesn't work for them, but normally they can stick a jumper, so that doesn't really matter to them. So it was those types of things. You'll find out more about your team. But I think part of that too is being open and honest as a coach to, okay, well, here's what I think, here's why I think it. Do I want to empower my players? Do I want to be a bit of a dictator to my players and say, well, you can only do these things? I think there's actually something to it. And I was watching a film clip a couple of weeks ago with Emma Hayes, who was the Chelsea women's football coach. And she spoke about the first year she was the coach there, she just had a child. So she'd become a mother for the first time. And she spoke about, I wasn't emotionally available for my players that first year because all my eggs were in my kids' basket. Whereas this second year, now I know how to balance it better. So she's going to be a little bit more aware of what's going on, the psychology behind it, the interaction, those types of things. And it was really fascinating. It's like, well, that's probably what most of our coaches are dealing with, is a home life that, I mean, they're volunteer coaches. They come in and coach because that's kind of the happy place, but sometimes you're not always there. And your players need to understand that too. Like, sometimes you've just had a bad day at work, you roll into training and it's like, I don't mean to be angry at the people in front of me, but maybe I'm taking this out on them. Do they understand why I am this way and those types of things? It's a really fascinating sort of look into coach behavior or mannerisms or those types of things. But you have to have a relationship with them where you might be able to walk in one week and just sort of say, hey, I'm going to need to lean on you a little bit here because I've had a week. Can you kind of carry us through what I need to carry you through?
I've done that a lot. I've done that a lot.
Yep.
And I say it to the Monday 8 p.m., 8 till 9 group. Like, I'm like, I've already been here for 2 hours. There's a reason why I've put all the guards last. Like, you guys are meant to be leaders. And I've also said it with my youth league team as well. Like, I'm a little flat. I've just been away at a nationals or whatever, and I need you guys to, and they're great with that. Yeah.
And I think it goes the other way as well. Like, yeah, we have those days, but players can have those days as well where they've got stuff going on at home or at school or with their friends. And if you don't have those relationships, you might not notice that, but it might be just take them to the side. Like, do you need a minute? Are you okay? What can I do for you tonight type thing? But if you don't build those relationships, you're not going to recognize those things. And I think it's really important.
Yep. And I think, once again, young Rob, maybe butchered this a little bit, because I used to have my players fill out like a little card as they were walking, like, how sore are you out of 10? Any injuries I need to know about? How are you mentally? And those types of things. They just ranked themselves out of 1 to 4. I think it was like above the line or below the line. And it gave me a little bit of insight as to, well, okay, how are they feeling? In reality, I should have been observing the body language, the language they were actually using around their teammates and those types of things. I was probably trying to do it the lazy way rather than building a relationship with them where I could actually pick up on those types of things as well. You'll notice it, and I think we notice it with players more than anything else. We're probably likely to notice a change in a player's behaviour before a parent will. They see them all the time. Like, it's, they just sort of blend into the roller coaster that is potentially teenagers or young adults in that world. Whereas we have a little bit of removal from them. It's like when you haven't seen someone for a while, it's like, hey, you've grown. Like, the parents wouldn't notice it because they see them all the time. The behaviour side of things and building that relationship to be able to walk up to someone and say, hey, is everything okay? What do you need on our end? And sometimes it's like, I just don't need to talk about what's going on. Cool, we're good.
Yeah, and that's
like,
okay.
Do you think? Yeah. Like, if that's what you need and you just need us to be positive and happy around you, we can do that. That's real easy. It might mean you don't get on them when they miss a cutter on a cut. It's like, hey, I don't need to highlight this. I need to walk past and say, hey, make sure you check that. Yep, got it. No worries.
Got the next one.
But those types of things. I think there's a way to get there.
Yeah.
In our end. The next one on my end, good footwork's a cheat code for mine. If you can play without travelling, and we know it's not called all that often, like, we get it, but if you can play with footwork, with balance, with the ability to make passes off both hands because your footwork is solid and your movement is solid, honestly, you can play at any level. It is one thing. You talk to any coach over the age of 50 and you ask them, what's the one thing you changed? It's like, our footwork is terrible now compared to what it used to be. I get it. Like, it probably is. The zero step probably hasn't helped that, to be completely fair with it. But I genuinely believe if you have good footwork, you are going to be in a much better position to do everything else. And we do see it with our bigs, I find, in particular, that are a little bit heavier, not quite the nimble movers. They are the slower movers. But just basic things like skipping can just go such a long way to improving that level of footwork with our players to be able to play at that level. And I know like MPP used to have a lot of skipping involved in it. Do you guys still do that before sessions?
Yeah, Jenny does. Yes. Yeah.
Girls do? Yep. Yeah. Is that sort of injury prevention as well as sort of get warmed up? Those types of things?
Bit of everything. Yeah. I think skipping's a great tool that you can do anywhere. And I think when the girls, their first session, very uncoordinated with their skipping. But by the end of the block, they're generally much better.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a great tool that can be used.
Phenomenal. And even just, it doesn't have to be the 2 foot on the spot. Like, you can go the boxer skips and all those. Like, there's so much stuff you can do with it, I think, that can help develop footwork and even just the jumping and landing. Getting some load into the knees, ankles, hips, those types of things before a session starts, that'll help footwork exponentially. Like, it's a phenomenal warm-up. Probably the hateful side of me is, like, we don't really have enough room for everyone in Victoria to be skipping on a Friday night around the courts and those types of things. But if you can find some space to get into that and get warmed up, I genuinely believe it will serve you well as a player more than anything else. Ball screen defense bestie should appear in every training session. Getting a little bit of insight into you as you're a defensive coach here.
No, I just
taking over from Coops.
His ears are burning on a plane at the moment.
There's been multiple occasions where people have heard me say this jokingly, but, you know, war, famine, and pick and roll D in that order. You know, like that.
I've not heard you say that before, but no, wow.
I think I added COVID in there at one point.
Yeah, I think right? It was.
Yeah, but, you know, obviously it's. It's not in that order, but it is very important. Like, it's
pick and roll D's a bit higher.
Yeah, definitely. It's first. The biggest issue you see, like, the frequency of ball screens in games is through the roof. So if you can't guard it, like, you're going to struggle. It's just It's the same as the logic behind the importance of it is the same for the D-trans, right? It's the high frequency of it, so you've got to be good at it. It's that simple for me. So you've got to have a plan A, you've got to have a plan B, and there probably needs to be a plan C at some point.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Like, how many different ways would you consider guarding an on-ball screen with one team? Like, obviously, 12s and 14s, don't worry about it. Like, they're just going to run into screens and hope for the best anyway. But so when you get to 16s, 18s and seniors, they're going to start seeing a lot more of it. How many different ways would you want?
You at least need three.
Yep.
Now, two of them you need to be good at, and the third it needs to be like, well, we're probably going to lose, so let's just try it.
In case of emergency.
Yeah, yeah. And the zone's not working. But, you know, even though, you know, good zone offenses still have pick and roll in them anyway, a lot anyway, so you still need to be able to do it. But, you know, I would think you would need at least two to be really good at, because if they're hurting you with one of them, you know, like sometimes the answer isn't just to bail out of plan A and, you know, go straight to plan B. We've all heard of, you know, sometimes plan A just needs to be done better. But you need at least two, and you need to consider the similarity of them. So they probably shouldn't be the same, like whether it's a hard show and a blitz, you know, like they probably shouldn't be the two. Yep. You know, you probably need two different types, I would say. Yeah. Yep. But we practice it every session.
Yep. So if you were a coach that is starting out teaching ball screen defense, what's the first one you'd put in?
The blitz.
Yep. Yep. Trap it straight away and get it out of their hands and, and cause some chaos. Yep.
For a few reasons. One, we just had a clinic with Lono around the offensive side of it, the skills that it creates with dealing with pressure. But I think the first one is for all of them, the way I teach them, except for an ice, you go over the screen. Like, you send it to the screen all the time, right? So that is consistent, whether it's a drop, a hedge, even a switch, you still send it to the screen, right? So that keeps that part of it the same. And I think with bigs, when you start to go into shows or even like a flat or maybe even a drop, they're always so worried about their player, and they need to have that awareness for sure of where their player is. But if you start with the blitz, it's like your player is not your problem right now. The ball and the player with the ball is your problem, so they can kind of sell out a little bit. But the biggest reason is it's 5-on-5. You know, like a drop is like a 2-on-2 pick and roll defense for the most part, right? Whereas if you start with a blitz, it's a team ball screen D. You know, so there's got to be someone to catch the roller. There's got to be, you know, whether you're denying the pass across the floor or whatever it might be. So, like, it's a team pick and roll D.
It has everyone engaged.
It does, yep. Right? So I also think it's easier to start with the most aggressive thing and then dial it back.
Yep.
Absolutely. So that's why I think.
Yep, completely agree with that. What's the last one you'd teach, Jen? Just out of curiosity, like, what is the one that I don't really want to teach my kids if I can get away with it?
Me personally, I am not a fan of drops.
Yep.
I just think that we have a lot of players who want to get downhill, and we are just playing into their hands doing that. I think that it's my least favorite, and I'll stay away from it where I can.
Yeah.
I think the point you brought up before about tournament versus season as well is really important with that, because, you know, we know the data around threes and layups and then the mid-range stuff. But if someone gets hot in a quarterfinal, you know, like it's over.
Yep.
You know, so the drop for league play, you can see some value, like more value of it as opposed to tournament play. I know it's Switzer, like we – even with Rocco and Jack, like, so Rocco was 7'4" and Jack's, you know, 6'10" or 6'11" probably now, and even Cooper was 6'11". Like, no, you got to be up at the line of it. Like, we had like a flat show for them because those guards were just too good, whether it was a pull-up three or whether it was just like get to the mid-range. It's like, we're not going to hedge our whole tournament on one guy making a few shots that we're just, well, we're not going to guard you basically. So I think there's a difference between league and tournament play with your pick and roll D as well.
Definitely. The last one I'd probably teach is actually switching. and completely take on board the drop sort of stuff. But for mine, switching just ends up being so lazy. Like, that's my in case of emergency break class.
Mm. See, I don't... You don't even need... That's what they do anyway. So
melt into a screen
yeah.
and hope. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, there's not even any point in... I don't even think about it because that's what they're all... All the teams seem to be doing that anyway.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah, so for us, we're doing hard hedge on the side, a soft hedge in the middle,
yep.
and it seems quite foreign to them.
Oh, really foreign.
SDP.
Yeah. We switch... Like our default on the boys' side, like 1-4, we switch it, but we wrap switch it, which is way more aggressive.
Yep.
That
I am okay with, just to, you know, again, mortally wounded, but yeah, dying on the hill, but I do like the wrap switching on those.
The point switch, like lazy, I'm just going to go under it. Like, yeah.
It's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel the pain so much, honestly. I really do. But I do agree that every offense will largely end with a ball screen when clock is winding down. You've got to be good at it. You've got to at least see it. Not to mention flipping it. If you experience getting trapped or blitzed on an on-ball screen, it's going to make your offense better.
Yeah.
That's the bit I really like, that your guard will now have to be dealing with pressure, surveying the floor. Where is the open player? What type of pass do I have to make? I can't make that, but can I make something else? Those types of things. I think it teaches a level of decision-making and IQ that maybe isn't really there with a couple of the other ones. So I'm all about the two-way teach on that.
So obviously one of our colleagues and the person that did my job two roles ago, if you want to call it, yep. was Mike Zeppel. He's out right now, and he had his team practicing at Hoop City, and they've gone a step further with it. Like, they're the people that are not involved directly with the ball screen on offense. Their actions off the ball are dictated by the defensive coverage. You know, so just all of that stuff it's important.
Yep, don't disagree at all. All right, Jenny, you're on next. Calling timeouts to stop momentum. Big believer.
I am a huge believer in this. This is me. I don't understand saving timeouts for the end of the game, because you get to the end of the game and you're down by 10 anyway and you don't need them. I just think stopping momentum when you need to is so important. That's what timeouts are there for. And again, it goes into season and tournament can be different. I think in tournament where you must win this quarterfinal, there's no point waiting to the end. I think once you've got a team for a season, you might understand your personnel. You might be able to do specific subs where you can get a momentum change in there. But I just don't understand coaches who save their timeouts for the end of the game and then never have to use them anyway.
Yep. No, I don't disagree with that. I'm notorious for saving timeouts in general, especially with 12s and 14s, where it's like, I actually want you to figure it out for yourselves. I can bail you out. I don't want to bail you out. Kind of work it out. 16s and 18s, blow. Like, that's your job as the coach in that world.
The you know, use it before 3 minutes thing. Yep. What about that? Like your third?
Yep.
I've let it, like, I've sacrificed it a lot. Because we might, like, if you're on a run or whatever, it's like, I'm not going to call it just to call it. Because yep. you know you're going to lose it.
Yeah. Zoe's spoken about it before. She was on a bench that called it just because they were paranoid about losing it and lost the game because of it. Like, that was the momentum that the other team needed.
Yeah, that's my fear. It's like, where things are going in our favor right now, there's a dead ball. I'm not, you know, it's 3 minutes and 8 seconds. Yep. It's like, should I take this? No, I shouldn't. Like, I don't want them to.
It's scary. Like, it's something you've got to genuinely consider. I know...
Do we add that to the list? Like, war, famine, pick and roll defense, third timeout decision?
Well, I'd love to be in a position where I've actually got three towards the end of the game. Usually I've burnt one at some point. Like, I know there was a national championships final in under-16s way, way, way back. I used two timeouts in the first 4 minutes of the third quarter. And the reality... And a coach sort of asked me, he's like, oh, you panicked. And it's like, wasn't panic. Like, I didn't have a choice. Like, we were down by 25. Like, what do you want me to do? Like, it's... I've got to try and change something. Like, if I'm, I can have those timeouts at the end, but we'll probably be down by 40 by that stage.
Yeah.
Like, we may as well roll the dice on it. And if I needed the third, I probably would have called it. And it's like, well, hey,
yeah,
we're cooked either way.
Yeah.
Like, what was the result?
We still lost. Yeah, okay. I think we got down by 26. We got it back to 11 and then lost by, I think, 20.
Yeah.
So it was just one of those things where we threw everything we could at it. Didn't change. Josh Dent got a hold of us. from New South Wales country, and we just couldn't deal with him at that stage. And he was a bottom age point guard of that tournament, which made me feel even worse.
At 16?
At 16, yeah. He was good. Like, he was a real good point guard in 16s. But yeah, like we just couldn't deal with it. We tried to change everything. We had a plan for it. It didn't work. We had a different plan for it. That didn't work. Like, we got all the way down to like F and G with our plants.
Yeah.
That's not an abbreviation for swearing, but it sort of came out a little bit at times. But it was one of those things. We tried everything. We kept calling timeouts to try and address it, and we couldn't. Like, it's...
And that's going to happen too, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd rather lose the game knowing, hey, we tried.
Yeah.
Like, I can
We've
look
given
my,
it everything.
Yeah, I can look my players in the eye and say, well, look, we gave it a crack. It just didn't work.
Yeah.
That's kind of how it rolls. All right, on to the next one. Do not foul jump shooters. It is, I joke with my players, it's punishable by death. It's not quite that bad, but it is certainly punishable by a sub. Like, I get the whole, you got to get out there, you got to contest, all those types of things, but do not foul jump shooters. The amount of people I see that don't even get hand contact anywhere near it, but there's usually a ref standing right there that gets really excited about calling a foul there. That's not the one that I see that gets called the most. It's the one where they stand underneath the shooter.
Don't let them land.
Yeah, it's that kind of thing. And it's like, well, any shooter worth a salt is going to just sit there and go, oh, I've been shot, you know, and fall over the place and try and get the foul call. Being aware of that sort of stuff is so crucial. Like, we've all had it in games where you feel like you're on a little bit of a run here. All of a sudden, you're forcing the other team into a potentially a rush shot, late clock, something like that. We've all had the foul with 3 seconds on the shot clock because someone goes and contests something a little bit harder than they should be contesting it. They give up a foul, free throw line, bucket. You've killed your own momentum in that sort of one. So I'm a big believer in get out there. Like, we do need to do more work on the closeout. I am a firm believer in that. It's the whole, and I've gone back and forth with this, and I've probably been the biggest guilty person with it as well, where I start a lot of my drills in disadvantaged situations to force scramble and those types of things. But I am seeing the payoff on the other end that our closeouts are quite poor because we're never closing out. So we've got to do more work on get to the closeout to make sure that we stick the ball first and we're not in that scramble as we move forward.
Yeah, Darren and I were just talking about that this
morning. It's the position before your closeout begins. Like, we're sinking in too much, and it results in this like lunging towards the ball that ends in that. Yeah, I think your point of stop trying to block shots when you're the primary defender. Like, it doesn't very often work.
Yeah, contest it's fine, but yeah, you don't need to. Like, how many times do you see a jump shooter get blocked by a closeout?
The only one you would see it is like, say, the corner three at the end of a shot clock. Like, yeah, sure. You know what I mean? Where they don't have time to put it on the floor or whatever. That's probably the only one.
Yep.
But most block shots come from the secondary defender at a high level anyway. And on the men's side, they do because of the leaping ability. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think obviously as we're going into seniors, the skill is high. And it's sort of part of the scout, I feel like, has to be these days. Like, Golding is going to kick out his legs. You need to know that when you're closing him out so that you don't foul him.
Yep.
And being able to know that and understand that in the scout so that you can close out appropriately to those types of players.
When you're seeing a lot more people now close out next to the shooter rather than at the shooter, which, you know, great way of doing it as well. Like, it's smart to those type of scouts. Like, if the legs are going to come out, don't be anywhere near the legs. Yep. Like, it's you're putting yourself in a terrible situation there. Bestie, we're on to you next. Where am I? Receiver work needs to be done at every training session. So
yeah.
Receiver shooting work.
Yeah, or the shooting side of it for sure, but even just where are your shots coming from, floor balance, you know, relationship between the person with the ball and the other people, like the other four players on the floor. If the ball goes here, you know, I need to go here. You know, I think it's not just split kick extra, you know, like we've probably got in love with that a lot, I think. And I think you get to your receiver spot, then make your decision, whether it's cut, feel behind, whatever it might be. But I just think that needs to be worked on every practice, whether it's, you know, depending where you're at with your season, maybe it's part of your warm up, it's some on zero stuff, or maybe it's 3-on-3, 4-on-4, whatever it might be. It just needs to be done. Like, your floor balance is important. It helps with your D-trans, it helps with your shot selection, it just creates an environment where the ball needs to move. I think it just needs to be done every practice.
I'd love for you to touch on what you spoke about this morning from our session last night in terms of passing as well.
Yeah, I just think a lot of shooters are missing shot opportunities because our passing is just poor. And then the shooter also being a receiver doesn't do a great job bringing their feet to the ball. We see a lot of like reaching for the ball, and I think the only time you should do that is if it's like on the baseline or on the sideline. Like it's going to, you are going to be out of bounds if you do that. But bringing your feet to the ball needs to be important too. Yep. Yeah, just the passing, driving, kicking, relocating, all of that stuff needs to be have some pop to it, and it needs to be, you know, you referenced the Spurs before, but you know, like they are the one everybody thinks about when, you know, those teams were really great at it. But it's just, it's so important. And when you get into that mode, your offense is over. Like, you know, as in from actions, like you need to have a plan. What happens when the ball breaks a 3-point line? You know, you're no longer in a set. You know, it becomes conceptual then. Yep. What are you doing? Who's cutting? Who's filling behind? How are you, you know, how are you being a participant in the play when you don't have the ball? You know, like you're either a participant or you're an observer. If you're an observer, if the ball comes to you, it's not going to be a good result.
Yeah, and I know Ash used to talk about it a lot when he was in the role as well. Like his teaching was hungry hands and legs loaded. Like how many of their shooters are actually prepared to shoot the ball if it comes to them as well? And we can get on the passes as much as we want because a lot of the time the pass is fairly poor. But if your hands are not where you want the ball anyway, well, you can't be disappointed when it doesn't hit them. Mm. Like it's one of those types of things. So you do have to be really conscious, I feel like, with a lot of our players, that how many of you are doing all the work to get open, to get your shot? Because you probably have like the smallest of small windows now to get your shot away. Like some of these kids closing out are massive and they get there quick. You don't have time to just catch, you know, potentially dip or drop and then come back up. It's got to hit the hands and go. That's not easy to do.
I've spoken to some of my youth league players about this, like standing in the corner with their hand straight up in the air, right, because they want the ball. Or even some post players doing that. I'm like, where do you want me to throw it, mate?
Yep.
You know, like, so it's, yeah, the hungry hands thing's good.
Yep, I like it. We'll lean into your next one, which was shooting when tired at training sessions. Big believer in that.
Yeah, so we'll often do our gameplay component, whether it's the shell or whatever, and it's shoot, then before. Like, shoot, then foul shots, then get a drink. You know, it's, or maybe it's shoot your foul shots, then shoot, then get a drink. It's never get a drink, then come back and shoot. That's how I do it. They've got to be able to shoot while they're tired.
Yeah, well, how often do you ever get to check into a game and get the first shot away straight away? Like, it just doesn't happen. So there's an element of shooting with fatigue. I know it was remember that Steve Nash workout? It was like the
5-minute one.
I think it might have been a 20-minute one where he bounced around like other sides of the key and all that sort of stuff. And someone asked him one day, like, why do you do it? And he's like, well, this is the closest I can get. Like, there's no point in me shooting fresh. I need to shoot when I'm tired.
Yeah.
Because by the time I've played 40 minutes, I'm spent. And as the point guard, he runs around everywhere like a lunatic. But that was kind of his thing. He's like, I need to be tired getting my shots up. Otherwise, there's no point. So I really like that, to be perfectly honest. It's, you know, anyone can make, well, not anyone, I still can't, but you know, most people can make shots when they're fresh. When you're tired, that's a different world.
Well, you know, when you're playing at your practice, you know, another one I had in there is you should always be winners and losers, right? So as soon as the team's done their penalty for losing, it's like the team that won should already have had their instructions to get set up in the shooting drill. And then the team that lost, as they're getting up from whatever it is, they're being told what it is for their shooting drill. They can also see down the other floor how the team's set up, and then it's like, bang, we're shooting straight away. And here's your chance at redemption straight away to get a win again.
Yep.
No. Or, yeah.
Really like that. And we'll just keep going with your stuff at this point. Athlete-led penalties. Big fan of them.
Yeah, I know I've shared the story with you before about at a national championships, a girl gave up an offensive rebound, and then I saw it on the film. So she gave up an offensive rebound and fouled, and then went off to the baseline and did 3 slides. Like during a game, right?
That's great.
One of my proudest moments as a coach. Yeah, I think it's just important. Like you build those things in, and you've got to be, you know, strict with it early on, and it gets to the point where the players self-manage it, and I think that's good.
Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No, I really like that. Jenna, we're on to you. Film review is under-resourced and needs to be made more accessible.
Yeah, I just think it's such a good tool for learning, being able to show what you're not liking and why, and then when it's done correctly and how it looks. So to be able to see themselves, I think, is just such a great learning tool. But I also know that it's really hard for coaches to get access for that. So I wish it was more accessible, because I just think for teams, for individuals, watching film on themselves, in terms of learning and improving, I think it's, yeah, as I said, just such a great tool.
Well, it's more accessible now than it probably ever has been, though. Like with mobile phones and tablets and all those types of things, it's not hard to film a training session or a game anymore. A lot of games have like Glory or League and those types of things in the roof where you can grab your game afterwards. One of the comms guys here, Brent, has designed an app called Buffer It, which is free to download. I don't know if there's a subscription in there. Like, take it up with Brent if there is. But it's one of those things where you can set your timer, and if you want like a 15-second lag time, it'll be filming the whole time. You just hit clip it and it'll grab the last 15 seconds of that and save it to your phone. So there's ways of being able to get film to your players that will really help them, because our kids now, as you say, learn more by seeing it than they actually – and recreating it if you have that opportunity to recreate it, and they do just being told. Like.
And I think court space is such an issue. You can't always get on the court, so you can get to training 15 minutes before and show some film, or stay after, because I know that you might only have a half court for 45 minutes or something like that. But to be able to show them and see what you mean, it's not individualized critique. It's we are all doing this, and this is how I would like it to be done, so that then they can actually go out there and recreate that. Yeah. I think it's just a tool that can be used more. Yeah,
really like it. Coops is smiling somewhere, just proud as punch that someone else other than him has mentioned video on these things.
It's important, you know. I'm just right as we say this, I'm just having a quick look to see, because I put our video review up from our game on the weekend before practice tonight, so I always want to see how many views it's had. So just give me a second. So some guys are going to get roasted. Oh, there you go. It's had 15 views. So
that's what there you go.
That's pretty good.
Love that.
That's pretty good. Pretty good. Pretty good.
Good, so, Casey.
Yeah, we'll
good,
see.
Good luck, Andy. No Coach of the Month awards coming your way.
We've been harsh on Andy. I really like Andy. He's a great coach of ours. He's a good server for Vic Metro and doing good things.
He is. Now we've got a lot of time for Andy, obviously, even if he's not the Coach of the Month, which is okay. It's
I've got to call him after
no,
this.
No, I've got to just warn him that it's coming.
D-bat.
Yep. I'm a big believer in that you always need to pick two different types of point guards in a team if you can. There is no point having the same point guard as the starter and the backup. If it's not working for the starter, it's probably not going to work for the backup. There needs to be a point of difference. So whether that be you might have a slower, deliberate point guard as your starter, and then you have that fast, erratic, out-of-control point guard as the backup, or vice versa. You might have some you know, shooting guards that you can swing in there every now and again and those types of things to pinch, but there's no point having just bulk of the same. Like, the same doesn't usually help you. I feel like there needs to be some variety in all of that. It doesn't necessarily mean that you are only one type of point guard, because there are those fast point guards that can be quite slow and deliberate with how they play, but there just has to be some variety in your roster. I'm a big believer in that. And that goes, I mean, it goes really with every position, but I feel like you find out more about it in the point guard spot.
Yeah, I didn't end up putting it in mine, but I did say to Darren in the car on Sunday that just the point guard position is so crucial. Yeah. And yeah, having two different types, it might be, yeah, a super just gritty defender who gets up, pressures full court, and as you said, is more deliberate in the half court offensively. And then you have someone coming off the bench who's flat out 3-point shooter, and you know, you need to have that balance. But I just think a point guard who can set up your team, who can instruct, who can lead, who is really that on-court coach, is just so important for a team. And I know that modern day basketball, it has been hedging towards that combo type guard, the 1-2 who's probably more of a scoring threat. I just think the point guard position is so very important.
Well, you don't realize how important until you don't have a point guard.
For sure.
It's one of those things. Like, I know the last team season I coached, I didn't have a point guard, or no one that had played as a point guard, and it was under 18s, and trying to develop one over the course of the season was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do, because it was just foreign to them. Like, they've defended point guards, but they've never had to run offense, understand why to call a play, what to run, what the tempo looks like. They didn't
understand
it. Who
to get the ball in the hands of, at yeah. what point of the game, all that type yep. of stuff is.
It legitimately is. I can't believe I'm saying this. I think you can get by without a center, but I don't know that you can get by without a point guard. Like, and that is probably counterintuitive to everything I've ever believed in my life.
But, oh gosh, your opinion changed.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes it works. Not always, to be completely fair. I'm rather stubborn. Just ask Zoe. But it is one of those things where I do genuinely believe it. Like, if you don't have a point guard, you'll find out about that real quick as a team. So that's one of mine. Bestie, we're on to your last one. Gameplay for 60% of the training session.
Minimum. Yep. And I think it depends, you know, how far along into your campaign you are as well. You know, like the further you get into it, you know, there's not as much teaching, I would think. It also depends on how your season's going too, right? If you're getting pumped, you need to, you know, clearly address some things. But if you're going well, you know, you should be not on repeat, I guess, but, you know, the players want to play. It's business time. You know, we know we're coming in, we're getting this done, and they want to play. I want to play. So,
and do you mean straight 5-on-5, or it's just all different types of gameplay?
All different types. But at least 50% would be 5-on-5, I would think. I know where we're at now with our youth league practice. You know, we're playing for most of it. Yep. It's just certain emphasis. Yeah, yep. That's after we've done our shell drill and our ball screen D and our transition D and our shooting when we're tired.
I don't think there's enough time in your training session.
Oh yeah,
we
practice for 5 hours.
Bestie session plan just writes itself. Like, he hasn't had to do a session plan for 5 months. They just come in, they know what's coming next. It's brilliant.
Sometimes I'm not even there. Yeah. I just watch it.
But and again, I must admit, that's something that again, thankfully, I don't have an inferiority complex, because, you know, young Rob as the coach butchered that completely. Like, the amount of times I would go into a training session and say, we need to get this stuff done, and my players would be sitting there saying, can we just play a game? And my answer would always be, yeah, cool, we can. Once you've got this right, then we'll play a game. When in reality, the players were telling me what they wanted. Like, they were telling me, we want more gameplay at our training sessions. We want to be able to scrimmage this and learn it, rather than doing like 2-on-0 handoffs. So it's like, well, hey, okay, we've clearly got to teach some of it, but can we teach it in a 2-on-1 or a 2-on-2 setting to actually make it a little bit more game-like in that thing? I think the level of transfer is far better, but the level of player engagement just goes through the roof.
Yeah, and you can manipulate the constraints and the scoring and all of that. But yeah, it's not uncommon now for us to finish our warm-up and we're straight into 5-on-5, some shell stuff, and then we'll quickly build into three-way and then shoot. And then it might be, okay, now we're going to work on this. So it jumps around a little bit, but players want to play. Yep.
I like it. Last one from me. Coaches, you've got to be coachable too. Like, it's just one of those things. You've got to be prepared to, if you're giving out feedback, you've got to be prepared to take it as well. Sometimes you'll get some info that you don't like, that you don't want to hear, that makes you uncomfortable. But as a coach, you've got to be coachable. Nobody wants to be unsupported as a coach. The easiest way to find yourself unsupported is to not take on board feedback, or to not listen to people that are trying to help you, because very quickly they'll stop trying to help you and they'll wander off, and then you'll find you are by yourself. You've got to take it on board. You don't have to agree with it. You don't have to action everything, but you've got to be coachable in what you do, whether that be tactical, whether that be technical, whether it be how you communicate, whether it be the motivational stuff, whatever, leadership. Whatever it is, you have to be as coachable as your players. You'd be annoyed if your players weren't coachable. You have to take it as well from various areas, whether that be you seek it out, because there is nothing more infuriating as a coach developer is when someone asks you for help, you give the help, and then nothing changes. That's the easiest way to, we're not having this chat anymore.
Triggering?
Like, a little, yeah. My foot is going up and down a little bit on the floor at the moment, but it is one of those things where it's like, there are people that are prepared to help, but you just got to take this stuff on board. It's, you know, the coaching fraternity is a very welcoming one. It may not seem it at times, but if people ask for help, you'll always get it. But you've got to take it on board for what it's worth too. In particular, if you can ask someone that doesn't have a vested interest in you and the outcome, you know it's coming from an honesty perspective. They're the best ones to get. Someone that maybe hasn't seen you coach for 6 to 8 months, then comes in, has a look at it and says, oh, what about this, this and this? And it's like, geez, I've never thought of that. Like, they might be the person you want. So, coaches, please do be coachable in that space. That's it's not an easy one, I understand it, but it is a vital one overall.
I think it goes back to your earlier point, taking the ego out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is.
They
go
hand in hand.
Yep. It's certainly something that I wasn't good at early. Like, I know that. Like, it's...
Same.
Yeah, I was horrific at it. But I also was a firm believer early on that tactics would win out over everything else that I did. And now I'm starting to learn, actually, it's not so much tactics. Like, tactics helps, but if your players don't have a skill set, if you can't communicate with them, if you can't build relationships with them, honestly, all the stuff we've spoken about during this podcast, if you can't get that right, well, it doesn't really matter what your tactics are at the other end of it. So That's a big part of it.
I remember when I first asked Mark Radford to give me some feedback on a game I'd coached. The first point I rebutted with an answer, and he was like, "Do you want this or not?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he goes, "Well, shut up. listen to what I'm saying." Yep. And I still call him like weekly for advice. Obviously, one of the great teachers in our game and great coaches that we have in Australia. But yeah, it's when you're younger, you've got to be like, you ask for this.
Yeah, wear it where you can.
Yeah,
like, I know Zoe speaks about it a lot. In Zoe's early coaching days, I was around her a fair bit and assisting her in those types of things as well. And she'll tell you about one of the car rides home where it's just like, hey, this is your fault, this loss. Like, you can't blame your players for this. This was on you. And she nearly drove off the side of the road and kicked me out. Like, it was one of those things. She didn't want to hear it. She's got a lot better at that over the years where she takes on a lot of feedback from a lot of people. And she's now at the point where she has to be selective at the feedback she takes on because it's like, well, I don't want to sell my soul for someone that maybe hasn't been around and is making a snapshot opinion on what's happened. But it is one of the things that I think it's the hardest time to hear is when you're a young coach.
So do you wait till you're home now or do you take separate cars? Or
separate
just,
cars.
Yeah. Just yeah
and make sure we don't call each other. We're like the the Uber drivers or something like that. They're always on the phone to someone. Like, yeah. I don't know who, but they're always talking to someone. So yeah, we just don't talk about it now and it's much easier, as it turns out.
Sam and I are different. We get in the car and we talk about it, and then when we're out of the car, it's like, nah, we're home now.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
To be honest, that is actually what we do. I was just trying to create content, but that's okay. Like, it's but no, it is one of those things where I do think there needs to be a separator too. Like, by the time you hit home, you don't want to be discussing what's just going on and those types of things.
That's
too.
That's the
like,
time. Yeah, decompress. And
yeah, I think the drive home is the greatest time to get everything off your chest.
Yeah,
where it's like, this is, you know, we have to be here anyway. I don't want it to impact on life outside of this, but now is where we can go over it. I know there are tons of coaches that will finish a training session or a game and call someone on the way home, and it's like, all right, what was good, what was bad, what do we need to change? Those types of things. That's the best time, in all honesty. So thank you both for jumping into it. Very much appreciated on my end. We are done for this week. Coaches, good luck with your teams, and we'll hear from everyone next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.